Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Bump and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Rost.
Here we go now.
Joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline, it's MLB.com's Daniel Kramer. Daniel, how's it going?
Hey, Stacy, I'm well. Thanks again for having me. How are you guys?
We're well. I mean, we've been talking about, Bump and I, this fight, obviously still the brawl between the two teams and now the suspensions. And I'm going to kind of work backwards because I want to get to the suspensions and how it could affect this team. But Daniel, you were out there. You were actually in the clubhouse getting some of those quotes from Mike Trout when he was, hit high and inside or nearly hit. Why, in your mind, were the Angels so set on this being intentional?
Yeah, it's tough. It was odd because I guess I'll first start with I spoke with Eric Swanson after the game on Saturday to just have him kind of walk me through the sequence. And, you know, when I asked him about the pitch that got away, it was almost like not a throwaway question, but it was just one of just like, hey, what kind of led to the intentional walk? I was more so going through the decision-making mm-hmm. process of, you know, Scott Service to – intentionally walk Trout for the second night in a row and have it pay off. And he was just like, yeah, I was trying to go high. Unfortunately got away and it sailed to the backstop. And you know, if I'm going to miss a spot, I need to miss it up. And I think if you like read that word for word, it doesn't look the best, but his tone and how he was describing it, I mean, it was pretty obvious that what his thought process was, which was that, look, this guy hit 5 homers off this last weekend in Seattle, and all of those pitches were in his, you know, sweet spot right at the bottom of the strike zone. I mean, his weakest spots as his owner in the upper rail. He doesn't do nearly as much damage up there. So that's what they were trying to do. And when the ball got to the backstop, the runner on first advanced to second. So now you do have an open base at first because the force out isn't there. And so Trout's faced Swanson twice now, and in his first at bat, he'd homered. So the matchup wasn't the best, and so the Mariners opted to roll the dice and, you know, take their chances with Shohei Ohtani, which worked. But after the game, you know, Trout, who is pretty even keel as it is, was noticeably frustrated. I mean, it was something I was talking about with the Angels writers, where we haven't really seen him, you know, that ticked off by, you know, a pitch in the past. Like we just haven't seen that kind of emotion from him. So I think there were a combination of factors that went into it. And the fact that, you know, the Angels are in the middle of a pretty trying season. They've got an interim manager there and a lot of things that aren't really going their way. And even their manager said after the game on Sunday that, you know, he's hoping that this can serve as a spark to get their season turned around. But I think was a perfect storm of circumstances for the Angels to really take offense to what was clearly an unintentional pitch. And it just kind of escalated really aggressively from there.
Daniel, I look at Nevin during this whole situation. I look at the night before where Trout is pitch high. He points out, he goes, look, the Mariners pitching coach goes out to the mound. Next pitch is high. Next pitch hits the guy. Then I look at his behavior during this whole scrum, and I see a guy who is trying to win his team over. I think he realizes he's an interim coach, or Skip, and he's trying to win his team over. And it's almost like he's desperate to do anything to have these guys believe, like, look, I am one of you. Do you think this could be a possible scenario going over there in Anaheim?
I mean, yeah, like I was just saying, like, they're in the middle of a really tough season, and they were in first place a month or so ago, and they lose 18 of 20. They fire, a manager in Joe Maddon, who's won a World Series. I mean, a guy who's beloved by his players. Yeah, it's a very tough situation over there. And I don't necessarily know if it's that he's trying to win over his players or win over a job, but I mean, he's certainly trying to prove himself. I think it's pretty clear that he wants to have his guys back and make it clear that he does have their back. Whether or not the logic behind that and based on what he perceived the Mariners' intentions were, was accurate. So there might be some validity to that.
All right, Daniel, tell listeners and Mariners fans what they should know about just the basics of suspensions. Can the Mariners stagger these? Can they call someone up? When might they find out about appeals? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, they're going to be hamstrung for sure. Word is that they're going to be able to stagger them. At least that's what they've been kind of loosely informed. But, you know, the folks that I've talked to, nobody really has a firm assessment on how that's going to look. But it, you know, none of this is good news, but at least that's like a glimmer of good news, because those three guys are their three best bats that are healthy right now. Because, I mean, they're already down Kyle Lewis, Mitch Haniger, and Ty France. Then you're going to take out JP, Jesse, and Julio. So having all of those guys out at once would really hamstring them. Unfortunately, they're going to have to play shorthanded if and when those sanctions go into place. You know, I asked Scott Services yesterday, are you able to, you know, add anybody to the 40-man and put that guy on your roster? And he says, no, we're going to have to play shorthanded when those come down. So that's going to put them in a tough spot, regardless of whether they're able to stagger them or not. And the appeal process, kind of murky from here. They're, you know, I talked to some of the guys in the clubhouse last night, and they're in the stage of working with their agents and working with the Players Association to kind of make their case. You know, Jesse Winker got 7 games, JP got 5, and they were called in the MLB press release for fighting. It was like specifically quoted for fighting. And then Julio got 2, and the release was a little more murky on that one. It said for his actions. And, you know, typically with these suspensions, you never really see them get entirely revoked, but usually, like, you know, they'll clip off a few games here and there if you make a strong enough case. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But of those three guys, Julio probably has the best chance, because I didn't see him throw up any punches when I was down there. Mm-hmm. The video replays that I looked at with multiple angles, never saw it. He's denied it. I saw him. He was as emotional and upset as we've ever seen him. And Manny Acta, their third base coach, was restraining him and holding him back. But I think it was more a reflection of just how upset he was at the entire situation, not necessarily that he was out there fighting. You know, Julio, multiple times since the incident, has said, you know, I wasn't throwing punches. I was trying to get people off. I'm not here to fight. But he still hasn't been given a clear reason for the suspension as of last night when we spoke to him after the game. So don't have definitive details on that yet, but should hopefully in the coming days as this appeal process continues.
Daniel, how do you feel the Mariners handled this situation? I mean, you look at all the whole scenario, the sequence of events, and obviously the Mariners could have went a different direction if not have done anything. The Angels could have done things differently. I think when it's all said and done, the Angels look like the bad guys in the situation, but that's just us over here in the Northwest. When we bring in the national media and the national fan base, how do they view this situation, and do they feel the same way we do and say, look, the Mariners did exactly what they were supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to look at this down the middle and not think that the Angels really got out of line on this one. I mean, they explicitly brought in an opener the morning of to be a hitman, mm-hmm. and to throw at a 21-year-old kid first, miss, and then still want to enact revenge. So they hit their cleanup guy with the first pitch of the second inning. I mean, that's the other thing. Openers come in and they pitch one inning, and they brought this guy back out for the second because they didn't want to risk their starter, their bulk innings guy, Jose Suarez, getting ejected because they still wanted to. They still had a ball game to win, so they weren't even really willing to stomach the chance of having their better pitcher get ejected. So it's not the best look, and that's something that Jesse Winker said yesterday. It's a bad look for Phil Nevin. It's a bad look for the Angels. He was obviously really frustrated at the sequence. You know, the umpire didn't immediately toss the opener for hitting him, and so You know, he's standing there lingering around home plate, and they're barking from the dugout. And, you know, he claims that that's what instigated it, was the commentary from Phil Nevin and Anthony Rendon, which is why he went over there. And at that point, he wasn't really willing to have a conversation. He just started throwing fists. And, you know, he was obviously very frustrated. So, yeah, just a tough situation all around. It's tough that it came to that, for sure.
All right, looking ahead to their homestand, they at least have a series here, finishing out a series against the Orioles, and then they're facing the A's. Now, they just lost 9-2 to the Orioles, so I don't want to say, like, oh, they got it easy here. I mean, but in terms of who you could be facing when you're hamstrung by injuries, this is somewhat favorable. How do you see the rest of this matchup playing off? How do you like the pitching matchup tonight?
Yeah, I mean, they just swept the A's in Oakland, so that plays into their favor. You got Robbie Ray back on the hill against Baltimore tonight. He got beat up by them pretty good in Baltimore, and I think he will admit that when they faced them last month. But he's kind of revamped himself in the few starts that he's had since. By expanding his repertoire a little bit and adding a two-seam fastball, it's helped him just widen the plate, widen the strike zone, give opposing hitters a different look. So I'm really curious to see, especially since that outing in Baltimore was so tough for him last month, to see how he bounces back from that and if he has any adjustments and how he attacks the hitters and everything, because that was a tough outing in Baltimore. Last night, not probably the way they wanted to start the homestand. George Kirby was either right over the middle of the plate or kind of nowhere near it. He just struggled with the location of some of his pitches, especially in two outs and two strike counts. Just couldn't quite put them away. And the Orioles are an aggressive swinging team, so they're going to come up there and they're going to swing the bat early in counts. And, you know, he realized that pretty early on. And, unfortunately, paid for it with four homers allowed. So not the way they wanted to start the homestand, but a learning experience for George nonetheless. And then, you know, a big four-game series against Oakland after going to the Coliseum and sweeping them last week. It's never going to be favorable to have three key guys potentially be suspended, but you're at home. You're playing two teams that aren't necessarily, you know, the class of the field in the American League. So at least they have some of that going for them.
Kyle Raleigh's been playing some good ball as of late. He really was brought here as a fill-in, right, to be the defensive guy. But his bat is getting hot as of late. Do you see this guy having a good career and being a true professional in this league? Is this something that he can sustain and not just a hot streak that he's on right now?
Yeah, I mean, they always loved him. His switch-hitting catcher who hit 29 homers in his last year of college or his first year of pro ball. I can't remember which of the – but they've always loved his bat. And he just soared through the minors. And last year, I think he was on like a 3 or 4 week hitting streak before they eventually called him up. And he just had a tough rookie season, learning how to navigate a big league pitching staff. He wasn't getting the offensive results right away, and you could tell that the confidence was just kind of dwindling as the season winded down in September when he wasn't chipping in. But he comes back this year. They begin the year with a three-man catcher rotation, which is just hard because you're not getting as much consistent playing time. And, you know, unfortunately for Tom Murphy and the Mariners, you know, their clubhouse leader and veteran catcher, he gets hurt. But that does create an opportunity for Cal to kind of have a little bit more runway at the catcher spot. You know, he's not always pressing when he does get his playing time or feeling like he has to keep proving himself. He understands that he's the guy and he's out there and that he's going to get the consistent playing time. And you couple that with some of the mechanical adjustments he's made. You know, really the big thing with him in the box is he's getting his foot down out front on time for the fastball. And, you know, fastball timing in the majors is everything. So if you go back and look at some of his big hits in Anaheim, you know, he's really getting that foot planted and just barreling up fastballs, which has helped open him up to secondary pitches and, you know, see breaking stuff a little bit better. So I think it's a multitude of things. The mechanical adjustments, the confidence that he's getting those results now, and the fact that he's kind of the guy because Murphy and Torrens, as of yesterday, based on, you know, injuring his shoulder in the fight on Sunday, is now out. So it's Cal's job. It's Cal's gig, and you know, he's earned a lot of trust and respect from his pitchers too.
He is MLB.com's Daniel Kramer here updating us about the latest with the Seattle Mariners. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
You too. This hour of Bump and Stacey is brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. It's time for Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with former Seahawks and Coug wide receiver Michael Bumpus.
First down, Bump. There have been so many quarterbacks in pro football that will go down in history for their performances and accomplishments. Why should we be talking about Marlon Briscoe?
Marlon Briscoe, I feel bad I didn't bring him up yesterday. He passed away at the age of 76 in California. He was the first black quarterback in the American Football League. He was drafted in the 14th round in 1968 by the Denver Broncos. They wanted him to come in as a receiver. He goes, nah, if I can't play quarterback, I'm not going to do it. He competes, gets a spot. He started five games for his rookie year, 1,500 yards, 14 passing touchdowns, 308 yards, three touchdowns. Then he switches up, goes to the Bills and the Dolphins, becomes a two-time Pro Bowler, and wins a Super Bowl. Again, he passed away yesterday at the age of 76. I think it's important that we shed some light on Marlon Briscoe.
I think it's also important for any of the guys who early on were pushing and challenging teams to allow them as black men to be quarterbacks. Because when people talk about that, the differences between the offensive coaching ranks going into head coaching ranks, they forget the history of typically teams being like, no, the quarterback's different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's so much history of keeping that role separate.
Yep. Marlon Briscoe, man, yep. We appreciate you.
Second down. According to ESPN, LJ Collier had one of the best springs for the Seahawks. What are things that LJ could have done to grab the attention of defensive coordinator Clint Hurt?
Now, this was surprising to me because when you're in these spring trainings, right, these mini camps, these OTAs, there are no pads. So the guys who suffer the most are the offensive line and defensive line because they can't really get after it the way that they want to. So what does LJ have to do to show Clint Hurt, like, look, I'm ready to go? It's all about technique. It's all about understanding your hands, your leverage, and where you're supposed to be, and then understanding what you do, how your job affects everybody else. Clint Hurt said he had one of the best springs out of everybody, and that is really encouraging to hear because we know he's had a tough road, right? He's been banged up a bit. He was a first-round pick, hasn't really lived up to expectations. So if Clint Hurt and ESPN are saying, look, he had one of the best springs out of everybody on defense, that's going to be great for this team. It's going to get some depth on this defensive line. I'm hoping LJ has a breakout year.
What kind of role was he playing when you were out there for OTAs and mini camp? Was it different than a role he's been in previously?
Well, they're trying to figure him out. They're like, look, is he an outside rush guy or is he an interior defensive lineman? And I think he's interior defensive lineman, especially now with the new scheme, with the backers walking down and them really being the rush guys. They need big bodies to occupy space. I think that's what LJ is going to do. And he just looks quick. He looks healthy. That's something we haven't seen out of him in a while. Did start a lot of games last year, but I felt like he was always behind the eight ball. This year, he seems more comfortable and he understands exactly what his role is.
Is it his size that makes him kind of the guy where, not a tweener, but where they're figuring it out? Or is it that he is fast enough to where they're entertaining the idea of him as a rusher?
I think it's his big body. I mean, when you're inside, you got to have that big body. You got to be strong. And I think coming in his rookie year, he was a bit lighter. But you know what happens? You get that grown man strength. You start eating good. You start lifting those weights.
Right.
You get big. That's what happened to him.
Third down. Joe Mixon says the Bengals may be one of the hottest teams in the NFL. Do you agree? And what needs to happen for them to bring back the year they had in 2021?
So going into this offseason, I said there's no way the Bengals are going to be able to do this again. They're a 10-6 team. They snuck up on everybody. They're not sneaking up on anybody this year. They have the league's attention. And why? Joe Mixon, 1,200 yards, rushing second in the league. Ja'Marr Chase, 1,400 yards, receiving fourth in the league. You got a defense that has a Pro Bowler in Henderson, 14 sacks, 3 forced fumbles. They're 26th against the pass, 5th against the run, 17th when it comes to allowing points. But this is what's going to be tough for them. They got the third toughest schedule in all of the league right now. They got to go to Tampa, to New England to the Cowboys early. Cowboys are typically good early, and then they got to play the Chiefs. So it's all about starting off hot, staying healthy, and getting these young guys to repeat what they did last year. But also they need to protect Joe Burrow, sacked 51 times last year. But what did they do? They upgraded on that offensive line. They got a new left guard, new center, right guard, brought in a guy to compete at that right tackle spot. So they're doing everything they need to do to be successful. But they're not sneaking up on nobody no more. They got the respect of the league.
Let me also say an underappreciated part of Joe Burrow's season was being sacked 51 times a year after tearing his ACL. Like, you came back, and the job of your team was protect this guy. He's our franchise guy. We cannot let him get hurt again. He didn't really get hurt again. I mean, he did get hurt a couple times, but nothing serious. But it wasn't for lack of trying. By other defenses.
Joe Burrow did not flinch. He is the coolest cat in the league right now.
He really is. Fourth down. NFL.com has a 2022 offensive all-rookie team, and Charles Cross made the cut. Bump, is there any other rookie in the league, league-wide, you feel will make this team that is not currently on that list?
Charles Cross, big ups to you, man. I'm glad you're getting some respect. I hope he lives up to expectations, but you know I got to start at the receiver spot. Right now they have George Pickens. He's with Pittsburgh out of Georgia as one of the receivers. Then Christian Watson, he's with Green Bay. Two receivers there are missing out. Drake London was the best receiver in the country, in my opinion. Maybe one, two, or three. You take your pick. This guy can do everything. Not really fast, but he's big. He's a possession receiver, but he will make you miss as well. And then Sky Moore, I've talked about him a couple times already. The guy with the Chiefs, he is going to be their Tyreek Hill. They're expecting him to get open and go deep consistently. We know that Patrick Mahomes can hold the football, throw from any arm, slide, extend plays. That's what makes him special. When you have a guy like Sky Moore on the outside, you can make things happen. Drake London and Sky Moore, peep these two receivers.
If you guys listening are like me, you're going to start talking to your friends and be like, yeah, I'm really high on Sky Moore. And just like, just hear it from Bump and then just pretend like, yeah, no, I mean, I'm like a super wide receiver insider as well. In fact, Curtis and I, with our wide receiver camp, we actually we were on Sky Moore a while ago before Bump even
knew about him. We knew him when he was ground more.
Yeah. Are you proud about that? Look at how hard Bump is laughing at that. Oh, God.
That one got me.
There's already too many dad jokes on this show. We're going to go to the timeline here. And as part of the timeline, there was a tweet, an announcement that I think might be the most self-righteous announcement I've ever seen. A very final question. What's the most self-righteous, pretentious thing that anyone, like a real person around you, the situation that you've been in where you thought, is this real? Is this really happening?
Rodgers, got anything?
I think what we're going to hear on the timeline might take the cake.
It would definitely takes the cake. I'll have to think, you guys have to think whether or not there was a real life example. Think about that. This hour of Bump and Stacey is brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. I'll tell you about that self-righteous announcement next.
This is The Timeline
with Bump and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This hour, Bump and Stacey is brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. It is The Timeline. Reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own timeline. So let's get it started with an incredibly self-righteous announcement. In fact, one so self-righteous, so pretentious, I actually love it. I can't get enough of it. Now, Curtis, Bump, if I were to ask you two to guess maybe the most self-righteous player in the NBA, who would you guess?
Self-righteous player in the NBA.
Self-righteous player. A couple names come to mind. But
yeah, I mean, I got one. We're going to talk about him right now.
Yeah, I think it's that point guard for the Nets.
It's that guy.
When announcing his decision to exercise his player option, Kyrie Irving had to get all self-righteous on us. Quote, normal people keep the world going, but those who dare to be different lead us into tomorrow. I've made my decision to opt in. See you in the fall.
What?
That was almost a good quote. Like, just if he were just to put the quote out and leave the I've made my decision to opt in, see you in the fall. Like, I'm reading it. I'm like, yeah, man. Like, different people do lead us into tomorrow, right? Einstein, Mandela, Gandhi. That's what's up. Oh, you're talking about yourself right now. My bad.
His decision to opt into $36 million. Like, that's not exactly a tough decision, Kyrie.
No, also, I like the idea. I like to think that he was watching and it was like an Apple commercial. Like, you know what I mean? When they're imagine like things happening. It's like normal people keep the world going. And it shows like just random people looking around and it goes, but those who dare to be different. And then it's like a kid doing math. You know what I mean? Like people like building science experiments and trying things out. They're in a field watching little rocket
with
ship toys.
White markers on glass.
Yeah. Lead us into tomorrow. And then you're like, ooh, this is going to be a commercial for space.
People thinking, staring off
what's
into space.
Gonna be? No, it's not. It's Kyrie announcing that he's going to be with Brooklyn. And the best part of all of it, you're opting in because no one wanted you.
Nobody. Nobody wanted you, bro.
That's the thing. Normal people keep the world going, but those who dare to be different lead us into tomorrow. I've made my decision. You had no other decision to make, Kyrie.
Yeah, the decision was made
for
you.
And I love you, but you had no decision to make.
Well, it would have been different if he like went to Europe and played over there. And like, I'm going to build this league up. You know, I'm going to take less than half of the money I'm getting over here, and I'm going to change the way this. No, you... Yeah, 40-something mil. That's an easy decision.
All easy. I know is that a phrase I don't say enough is normal people keep the world going, but those who dare to be different lead us into tomorrow.
That's a low-key fire quote. I feel like you guys aren't appreciating that part of the quote. It's the bottom, the second half, which kills it.
I feel like people who say that kind of stuff are double majors.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's why I love that quote. I'm going to like turn it into a poster that I put on the wall.
Stacey will take any chance she can normal to remind people, us of her being a double major.
Normal people major in one thing.
But those who dare to be different.
Major in two.
And lead us into tomorrow.
And also lead us into tomorrow. Next story here. Per the New York Post, MLB will waive the A's relocation fee if they decide to move to Las Vegas. Well, why is this news? That relocation fee was estimated to be around $1 billion. Now, with it out of the way, relocation seems inevitable.
Get up out of there, man. And Oakland fans, I feel for you. The Raiders play with your heart a couple times. You got the A's who are about to dip out on you. The Warriors said, nah, we're good. We're going over the bridge and going to San Francisco. Like, it's hard being an Oakland fan. But if you're not going to invest in your facilities, what do you expect at this point? If you're going to tank at the beginning of the season, let your fan base know, look, we want nothing to do with this place. It's bound to happen. I feel for you, Oakland, but goodness gracious.
How does your
team in Vegas would be awesome.
Well, that's the thing. How does your heart not break for the Raiders relocating to Vegas? Now the A's take Vegas, or excuse me, Vegas takes the A's. I shouldn't say necessarily that Vegas went in and swooped it up. I don't look at it quite like the group that shall not be named from the city that shall not be named swooping up the Sonics and the league kind of stepping aside to allow it to happen. This is more like the A's ownership is like, great, fantastic. We don't care about you guys. We don't care about this fan base,
not
this city. We
world.
Don't care at all. No, nope. You don't want to give us money for a new stadium. You don't want to celebrate us and do all this stuff. What we're going to be focused on is getting money, getting revenue in Vegas. And that's the thing. I don't believe this is a group that's going to try to win in Vegas, but you know what you're going to get in Vegas?
Entertainment. Yep.
Ticket sales.
Why not?
Advertising. Money. This is a group that has always just cared about, like, how do we just get money?
That's what it's all about. And that's what people forget. Like, you got your team. They've been in your city forever as you were a kid. You have all these memories. But end of the day, it's all about that paper. And they're going to leave and they don't have to get getting taxed for this. They can just move. There's no fee to move. You got to be out of there. You have to be out of there. So I feel for you, Oakland A's, but I promise you it's going to be a great show down there in Vegas, regardless of what their record is if they do make that move.
Someone on the text line already pointing out that Las Vegas, I'm going to call this as their logo now on behalf of this listener. It's already the A-S. So Las Vegas, and then you can have the capital A.
Las Vegas.
Las Vegas. Like, that's probably going to be some kind of promotion that they do for it. Next story here. Heading back to the NFL, kind of. Adrian Peterson and Le'Veon Bell will square off in a boxing match. Here we go. Why does every athlete just go to like, I'm going to go to UFC. I'm going to go into boxing.
Jake Paul, man. He ruined it. It's Jake Paul, man. He started all this celebrity boxing stuff. Like, this celebrity boxing stuff was already happening. But now Jake Paul and his brother just ruined the game for everybody. And low-key, I don't know if you guys know who Blueface is. He's a rapper.
Yeah, Blueface baby.
He is fighting Nick Young. I'm like, I might be more interested in that one.
What?
Yeah. He's
undercard. I am interested in that one. This is the thing. We can complain about it and we can criticize it, but it's doing exactly what its intention is to do, to get eyeballs and money on it. They're doing it every time. That's why they do it. So it's like the Paul brothers, they did it and they ruined it for everyone, but in a way where all these venues and in this league were like, oh, great. Fantastic. You mean we just have to get celebrities in here fighting someone?
Easy.
Done. And they're former athletes, so it's not like we're throwing random people into the ring.
But maybe I'm not.
The Paul brothers just ruined a lot for everyone.
Dang YouTubers.
I'm just not in the boxing realm. Like, I don't follow it at all. But it feels like there is more excitement and buildup to these kinds of fights than the actual title fights with guys like Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder and those names. I mean, maybe to boxing fans, people who follow the sport, those fights obviously mean way more. But I think to just the casual sports viewer, which is what boxing has not been able to attract ever since really like the Tyson Holyfield era. Like, it feels like these matches do more for that than any of the other title fights we see.
What's a bummer is that boxing couldn't do that with an actual boxer who was just a really exciting player that somehow was capturing attention.
They don't, because there's so much corruption in boxing with the promoters and all that stuff. Like, people have lost interest. That's why the UFC is killing it, because you don't have to follow the UFC just to appreciate what's going on out there. Now where the UFC is messing up is they're exploiting their fighters and not paying them what they deserve. So what do you do to grab the masses? You get a familiar name, a familiar face, you put them in the ring, and you go after it. I watch that stuff. It's like horrible reality TV. I know I shouldn't be watching this garbage.
Nothing wrong with it.
But I'm going to watch it anyway.
That's the thing.
It's entertaining.
Like, I can't turn away.
You're talking to people that love themselves some trashy reality.
Let me tell you what. We are like, yes, actually, for the next hour and a half until we bring on Scott Service, let's talk Netflix reality TV. Let's talk The Circle. You know what I mean? Too hot to handle. Now, I think, again, in the short term, it brings in money. It brings in viewers. But is it healthy for the sport long term? To me, it's gimmicky, and it's too gimmicky, and it's not making it genuinely something that people want to watch and learn about. That's the thing. You want to watch it. You want to see who's fighting. But, like, don't you want fans who then want to tune in to every big match, to even smaller matches, because they fall in love with the sport? I don't know that this makes anyone fall in love with the sport.
No, it doesn't. It's a mockery, low-key. But it's entertainment. That's just the world we live in, our culture. If you can entertain us, you can bring some type of familiarity to the situation, we're going to buy it and we're going to watch it. So they've tapped in to the right part of our brains.
All right, it's Bump and Stacey. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. We've been doing this thing every single weekday called a Pond Closer Inspection. Seahawks training camp is officially a month away. In fact, 30 days away, I think. So now under a month away. And we've taken a look at defensive backs. We took a look at linebackers. That continues next. I'm going offense for this one. I'll tell you what it is next.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studio, this is Seattle Sports Station. You're listening to Bump and Stacy.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners are back at it with a game against the Orioles today, game two. Let's see if they can bounce back. Robbie Ray gets the start. First pitch is at 7:10 p.m. Pre-game show starts at 6 p.m. right here on Seattle Sports Station. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company. Bump, we've been taking a look at all the position groups. We've been having you do a breakdown. And the basic format's simple, right? Your biggest concern, biggest lingering question, and then one thing that fans should absolutely be excited about. So you can look at it from an honest perspective, but also with some upside and some excitement. So kind of a balanced approach here. Upon closer inspection, today's group, wide receivers.
Dub R's, baby. My guys, the guys who make the plays that you all love. The ball's 50 yards down the field. They're making the plays. So I'm going to start with my biggest concern. Is that where we're starting off
with? Yeah, let's do it.
All right, my biggest concern is going to be D. Eskridge. And it's because he hasn't shown that he can be healthy, right? He had that concussion, which you can't really control. He smacked his head on the ground. The ground wins that battle 90% of the time. And then he has a hamstring issue. When you're a fast dude and your hammy starts to bug you a little bit, that thing starts to linger a little bit. He is supposed to be the guy to be the jet sweep, to be like the unconventional football type play, right? The quick screen, boom, let him go and get money. So now I'm thinking, how is he going to contribute to this team right now? It has to be in the return game. What has the NFL done to the return game? Damn near eliminated the return game. Kickoff returns aren't big anymore. If you're going to get your money, it's going to be on punt return. But I'm just concerned because I want to make sure he gets every opportunity to be successful. What have the Hawks done this offseason? They brought in some more receivers. You draft Bo Melton and Derek Young. You still got Cody Thompson. Penny Hart is still here. Aaron Fuller, Kay Johnson. When you look at Marquise Goodwin, the veteran is here now. When you look at camp and the bodies, the volume of bodies per position, the receiver position is one of the positions that have the most guys because you can rotate these guys in. Then you look at offensive line because there have been some injuries there. I'm just worried about the young guy, D. Eskridge. I think he has all the capabilities to be a good receiver in this league, maybe a number three, number four on this football team, and then ease yourself into having a bigger role. But if you're not available, we're never going to be able to see what you can do. For him, I just want him to be healthy and get out on the football field.
All right. I also want to see him be healthy. And I got to say, for D. Eskridge, it's only his second year, but you don't want to be in danger of falling into that kind of trap of they've moved on and replaced whatever role I was going to have. And now there isn't a role for me, right? Because it's kind of where Marquise Blair finds himself, where he's insanely talented. The team is really high on him, but he can't stay on the field. Well, now Jamal's got strong safety locked up. Justin Coleman, who has been their best nickel in his first stint with Seattle, is coming back for another stint. Ugo Amadi's already in there competing. So you're kind of looking at, like you said, can I make an impact on special teams? So D. Eskridge, there's still absolutely a role for him, but he's got to stay healthy. Let's talk about what you're most excited about and what every fan should be excited about.
It's the obvious. You got Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. I think DK is going to get a deal done. They're going to be good to go. If these guys can come back, they're going to lean on these two to lead the charge. Tyler Lockett, 1,000 yards last year. DK, 900 yards last year. When these two are on point, when DK is making the big play down the field, when Tyler Lockett is making the tough catch, that's going to be a great crutch for whoever the quarterback is, whether it's Geno, Drew, Baker, Jimmy, and even Jacob Eason. Man, I'm going to vote Jacob in there. We don't talk about him enough. I know he's a dark horse in this race, but he's still on that roster. But you have one of the best duos in the league. I say a top five duo in the league, something that you can rely on and that you can count on. Now it's about just making sure these guys are implemented into this offense in a way to where they're going to be successful. Because you don't have Russell Wilson, the guy who's going to spin in the backfield, roll to the right, throw across the left, not take the check down, go for the home run balls. People are concerned. They're like, okay, how do these two fit into that? I think with this offense and what Shane Waldron's going to do, there are still opportunities for these guys to make big plays. The good thing about DK, he's a good run after the catch type of dude. Not a guy who's going to make you miss, but he's like a Cadillac, baby. Once it gets going, you drive down that five. It might start off a bit slow, but now you're coasting. You're going 80, 90 before you know it. And Tyler Lockett is like the utility guy. Mm-hmm. He can go deep. He can go across the middle. So I understand the concern that the 12s might have as far as getting these guys to football. Their numbers might suffer a little bit. But their numbers may suffer, but that means the tight end is more involved. That means Rashad Penny is healthy. That means Ken Walker is contributing. And that means that maybe a guy like D. Eskridge is getting money as well. And can't forget about Freddie Swain. Freddie's been holding it down. Has been really reliable. But why you should be excited, you still got 16 and 14 out there.
That's
for
right.
you.
What do you think about the rookies they brought in, by the way? Did you see much of them? I know that I don't know if one or both were injured during rookie camp or OTA, so maybe you didn't see a ton, but what do you think of those two?
Yeah, they were banged up. You know, they had the bucket hats and the towels over their necks. But
the bucket hat is when you know, like, that guy's out.
The bucket hat, it's a wrap. But
like a red jersey.
I watched their film. They can get it done. I mean, Bo Melton over there with the Rutgers was a good receiver. Outside guy, about 5'11", does about everything. Got Derek Young. He is the nasty, I want to hit you receiver. He played tight end. He even played a bit of running back in the slot. He's played outside. But we'll see during preseason because you're right. They were not available a lot during OTAs and minicamp. So their time to shine is going to be these preseason games. I think they're going to compete.
Yeah, I do agree with you that you're looking at the numbers probably dropping for these guys. I mean, the most passing yards in any single season for a Seahawks quarterback, I'm pretty sure they all belong to Russell Wilson. I think any season with over 4,000, I believe, belongs to Russell Wilson. They have not been, not just under Pete Carroll, but as a franchise, a team that's thrown the ball a ton. And as we know, part of that's the evolution of the league. You're not going to find many quarterbacks prior to, a couple years ago that were throwing for 4,000 yards. Drew Brees was really the first guy to kind of make that a thing, at least regularly. So I understand that the league has evolved to be more of a passing team, but I do wonder in a more modern NFL, are we going to see a Seahawks offense that looks at that many passing yards? Probably not. So does that mean that Pete Carroll and I almost said Brian Schottenheimer and Shane Waldron are looking at DK and Tyler like, how can you block for us? Like, do their roles day to day change?
A little bit. Week by week, I would say. But they're always going to be their priority or their main job description is going to be to catch the football. Yeah. There's no way you ask Tyler Lockett to become a great blocker. He'll give you all the effort in the world, but reality is he's 5'10", 5'11". Like, you can ask DK to help on the outside and be a good blocker, maybe even bring him in sometimes in a tight formation and then they burst out. But end of the day, these guys are receivers. They want to catch the ball. They want to make the big plays. There's always going to be some type of wrinkle in the offense to where they might line up in a different position or might do something else to set up a different play. But end of the day, they want to catch that rock, and they are some of the best in the league at doing that.
All right, that was upon closer inspection for the Seahawks wide receivers, taking a look at every Seahawks position group as we head further into the offseason and prepare for training camp in less than a month from today. Coming up next, unlike Dan Snyder, we are putting some people on trial here, the Seahawks quarterbacks. You got two on the roster, two that have been rumored to this team via trade, though are currently not signed. We're going to make a case for and against each one of these guys. That's next.